Welcome to the Lost Together podcast with Matt Wardlaw.
Hello, everybody. As you're hearing this, it's June 22nd. I'm getting ready to head out the door to go to Williamsburg, Virginia, to see the inaugural edition of Bruce Hornsby's Funhouse Fest. It's going to be a great time. Bruce is going to kick things off Thursday night with a solo piano performance that's separate from the actual festival. Friday night, he's playing a set with Ricky Skaggs in Kentucky Thunder. Saturday night, full album performance of his new record, Rehab Reunion, as well as a full album performance of the Way It Is album, as that record is marking its 30th anniversary this year. Sunday night, Bruce and the Noisemakers are just going to be doing a regular set made up largely of fan requests. Bruce has a large selection of musical friends who are going to be playing sets this weekend as well. Railroad Earth, Sean Colvin and Steve Earle, Taj Mahal, and quite a few other folks. I mentioned this, all of this stuff on the outside chance that you're looking for a fun weekend. Well, if you're near Virginia, this might be your ticket to a whole lot of weekend fun. Check out funhousefest.com for all the details. Now let's get to this week's podcast, which features an interview with John Hampson from the band 9 Days. After releasing a few records independently in the mid-90s, 9 Days signed a major label deal with the Sony subsidiary of 550 Music and released the Madding Crowd album in 2000 and scored a big radio hit with a song that you're all going to remember, absolutely, The Story of a Girl. I can remember getting a copy of the Madding Crowd at the radio station I was working at long before any singles were released, and I put it on and found myself just listening to song after song after song of excellent pop rock hooks. Their major label experience didn't end well. Although the Madding Crowd went gold and absolutely charted inside the top 10, their planned second record was shelved as their label imploded and the band found themselves in limbo. They eventually soldiered forward and were later able to release the album themselves, first putting it on their website for fans to just download. Understandably, it seems like the experience of having that record shelved kind of killed the forward momentum for the group, and it's a shame because as a fresh listen to the Madding Crowd reveals, they were really on a solid track, and you can hear that, not only with the singles, but also from the songs on that record that weren't singles that could have been. They were, and they are, a very talented group. And as we're talking here in 2016, 9 Days is about to release a new album called Snapshots on July 8th. The album was produced by Jim Scott. You probably know his work with bands like Wilco, among others, and I loved his work on the Connells Still Life record. The album is a mixture of both clever, catchy pop rock songs that will appeal to folks who really like the Madding Crowd album, but it also shows off the introspective side of this group's songwriting really well, and lyrically shows the growth that comes with adding a couple of decades of life experience to your overall story. The band collaborated with some outside songwriters, including former Nixon singer-songwriter Zach Beloy, who has made a big name for himself in recent years as a songwriter and collaborator with a bunch of different artists. As I mentioned, Snapshots is out on July 8th, and here's a sample listen to the record, a song called Green Light, which is one of the first things that they've released from the album. Pre-order the album, and you can get that song and a couple other songs as well.
If life's about moments, make them count. Don't hide in the shadows, live out loud. There's never been a better time than right now. This night together we can own it. Whatever you want, we got it. If it feels good, then it can't be bad. Might be the best thing we ever had. Come on, come on. Too far. far without dreaming. You can't fly with your feet planted on the ground. Oh. Whatever you say, you better mean it. My heart's a drum, you better beat it. Come on, come on, give me that green light. Lean in for a sweet ride. Slide over to me, here by my side. Give me, that green light. We won't be needing no rewrite. You know we'll never get this time again. Hands up, all in, yeah, here we go. Here goes nothing. Here goes nothing.
There you have it, Green Light. Quick sample for you guys from the new 9 Days record, Snapshots, which is out July 8th. Visit the band online at 9daysmusic.com. They are on Twitter at 9daysband, where they've been posting a lot of things leading up to the record release. They're also on Facebook, and they've got some shows on deck that they'll be playing after the record comes out. We're going to talk about all that during our interview with John Hampson today. Thanks for listening to the Lost Together podcast. Visit us at losttogetherpod.com. Send me an email at losttogetherpod@gmail.com. And Facebook and Twitter, Lost Together Pod is the place where you'll find us there. Here's today's interview. I hope you enjoy it.
It's cool to be talking about a new 9 Days record, which obviously for those keeping track at home is called Snapshots. And it seems like the idea of a new album is something that's been hanging around for a little while since the last record came out in 2007. And I kind of wondered what finally kicked things into motion and brought it all together.
It's a long path, but I'll try to edit it down to, you know, a soundbite. I should have a better answer prepared, but basically, to try to kind of sum it up, the band never broke up.
Right.
We've known each other for a long, long time, and you know, we went through a lot of different hoops. Obviously, we had like major label success. Then we went through a very sort of cliche major label meltdown story where our label imploded and our follow-up record never really got released.
Yeah.
And we sort of, it was a long road going through all of that, even though it wasn't a long time. You know, it's funny, you look back, it feels like it was this epic chunk of my life, but it really happened fairly quickly. And basically, we all kind of just went on with our lives a little bit. You know, we kind of moved forward and some of us started families. Brian moved to Nashville, and we all just kind of found like a sense of our, you know, what we really wanted to do with our lives outside of 9 Days. And then right around 2007, like you're talking about, we put out an EP, and that was really us kind of coming back together and, you know, not letting 9 Days go. And then over the years that followed, we'd play shows, we'd record some stuff. We did like a sort of a fan album, which we never really put out. We just kind of released it to fans with like a pledge campaign for it, which was a lot of fun. That was in 2012. And then right after that, we hooked up with some management out of Nashville. And it just kind of reinvigorated the whole band. You know, it just made everybody feel like we were able to look at the band very differently than we were had been able to. You know, it was kind of a mixed bag for a while. You know, you have this incredible high of success followed by this incredible just how does this happen moment.
Yeah.
So really this album is the last 2 years of us feeling really good about making 9 Days a priority and it's filling a space in all of our lives that felt really good.
Well, I mean, you talked about like the incredible success of the band and then how quickly like things kind of just like blew apart, you know, due to the label. Are you surprised that like you guys were able to maintain the friendships and like hold it all together?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not really surprised. I just think that, you know, we fell into a lot of the traps that a lot of bands fall into. But at the same time, I think we all had this sort of detachment to the whole experience to a degree. Like we all kind of recognized that what we were experiencing was a bit surreal and didn't feel completely authentic. I don't know if that's a great way of putting it, but it was amazing. You know, it was an amazing experience, but we never felt like a band that was built for that. And I think our label recognized that we might not be a band that was built for that. And when we did make the follow up, it was either going to be a grand slam or a strikeout. There was no in between as far as they were concerned. And when they didn't see it being a grand slam, they basically just, they bailed out. And
yeah,
at the same time, the label really was going through a complete shift. Like a lot of the people that were working our album, literally, I think were gone within a few months of our album not coming out. Once that decision was sort of made, when they pushed it back, nobody had a job there anymore. So of course the record was never going to come out.
And you guys, like, even at the time that success happened, I mean, you guys weren't a new band. I mean, you guys had like, you know, 3 independent releases leading up to that. And you have a song like Absolutely Story of a Girl. I mean, that was one of those songs that, as you know, I mean, it was the song. Like sometimes like bands and artists, they'll have a song that's like the song that just blows up so unbelievably huge. And I mean, for you guys, that definitely was the case, and that was an album and a song that a lot of folks bought.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that really has to be something to process in the moment when it's all going down.
Yeah, it was, look, it was amazing. And the truth is, you know, it's hard to go back and, like, disassemble, you know, your steps of your life. But had that song not happened, it would have been a lot harder to keep the band together and to keep the friendships going and to maintain a reason to continue to carve out a time in your life for this thing. So, you know, yeah, we're called a one-hit wonder. We are a one-hit wonder in that sense. But that one song has just given us so many opportunities to continue to make music. So it's not the career I would have charted. You know, it's not the situation I would have, you know, written out for myself when I was, you know, a senior in high school and daydreaming about being a rock star. But it's not bad either. You know, it's been an interesting ride.
What was the name of that the record that you guys put out via Pledge?
It was called Something Out of Nothing, and it was very much a throwback record for us to how the band started. When Brian and I started the band, we really were hooked on this idea of kind of an Americana style thing, but a little more pop. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Counting Crows is probably a decent landmark, but I mean, we didn't sound anything like them. But they were just a band that we kind of felt like, well, okay, they're doing something that's similar to what we'd love to do. Not the same, but, you know, they're taking these very Van Morrison band, Bob Dylan-esque roots things and kind of turning them around a little bit, and that's what we were really excited about doing. And So when we kind of got back together to do the Something Out of Nothing album, I was really pushing. I was like, let's just go back. Let's just, you know, instead of trying to make this big, you know, kind of rock record, which, you know, we were a rock band for a while. I said, let's just kind of go back to acoustic guitars. Let's go back to the mandolin, the harmonica. Let's just kind of make this really rootsy album. And I loved making that record. I loved the record. We probably played 20 or 30 shows that year for that record. And it was really a great experience. Ironically, that's the experience that got us back to, you know, getting a manager who sat us down and was like, you know, guys, I feel like there's never been a true follow-up to the Madding Crowd. Like you never got to make that album and have it come out and make any kind of an impact. And that became sort of the mission statement for Snapshots, which was, here's the record that should have followed up the Madding Crowd, you know, if you could sort of bridge 2000 and 2016.
This particular record, like, it's interesting to hear, like, that's a good way to frame this record up as kind of a follow-up to that record, but it also sits very much in the now and feels like something that you guys would have done here in the present day. Like, sometimes bands have that intent to do a record where it's like, you know, we're going to kind of like do a record that would have been the follow-up to that kind of record, and it feels forced. This doesn't feel forced. Yeah. This still feels like a legitimate 9 days record that you guys would have made anyway.
You know, first of all, it's great to hear you say that, because one of the tricky things for a quote-unquote for an artist, to use the lofty term, is to make something that feels entirely real, you know, authentic to you, and yet also kind of have a almost like a there was something we were trying to do, but it had to also feel right. And a big part of that step was bringing in Jim Scott to produce the album.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with Jim, but I mean, Jim's done these Wilco records that I'm literally just in love with these records. And, you know, I knew that Jim had mixed Sky Blue Sky, which is probably one of my favorite records ever. And,
oh, yeah.
And then he'd also produced the Wilco self-titled. You know, it's funny, as we're talking, they're delivering Snapshots to me right now, the actual CDs. Hold on.
Oh, very cool.
How are you? You too. Yeah, so there's 500 copies of Snapshots sitting on my porch right now.
Awesome. It's real now.
It's real. I'll open it up when we're done. But, you know, so bringing on Jim was a way to kind of be the last set of years, almost like a gatekeeper set of years. You know, like we got super close to everything, like all, you know, writers do and bands do. And so, you know, Jim would kind of help us pick through the stuff that just was the best stuff. And, you know, one of his things would be like, I smell a rat. You know, whenever he thought we were getting too clever, you know, whenever he thought we were maybe trying a little too hard, you know, he would kind of call it out. And it was just great to have that last person there. And in the end, you know, making records is hard because when your resources are limited, and that includes time. You know, like our A&R guy who signed us ages ago, Mio Vukovic, who incredibly coincidentally turned out to be the guy involved in the whole Wilco debacle at Reprise Records. But
oh, wow.
Side note.
Wow.
Yeah, it's funny. It was after us, but I always found that really interesting. But Neil used to say to us that you never finish a record, you just run out of time or money.
Right.
And, you know, we ran out of certainly money, but, you know, time is tough too. And so we made the best record that we could at that particular moment, and Jim really helped us shape it and sonically made sure that it was, you know, the way that we wanted the record to sound. So I do think in this really cool way, it does feel like the spirit of the Madding Crowd, but it also feels very much a part of 2000, you know, this era of making music.
It's, sure.
So it felt like we had, you know, essentially succeeded in what we set out to do. And when you feel that way, the great part is then you can sit back and let it be, and you don't really worry too much about how it's going to be received, because you're not second guessing yourself. You're just like, you know, this is what we wanted to do, and whatever happens now is out of our control. So.
And how did Jim end up in the mix for this record? Did you guys know him back in the day?
No, I didn't know him. I just knew of him, and you know, he's got a tremendous track record. I mean, it's not just local records. The guy's been doing. He was a big part of that sound. What is it called? The Dave Grohl documentary.
He's Sound
been
City.
A lot.
Yeah,
Sound City. So the funny thing about this, we've been talking to a bunch of producers, and I had Jim on my list, and my manager hadn't gotten there yet, and I just got a little impatient, and I basically just was looking him up, and I found he had like a studio in California that he likes to work, like his studio, and it was just a contact button, click, a link. So I clicked it, sent a sort of a blind email, and he got right back to me, and we just started talking, and he just, you know, right from the get-go, there was just a connection and a very similar kind of idea of how to make a record and what we wanted to do, which was very much the band recorded live and then go in and, you know, put in some fun bells and whistles stuff like we always do. But Jim just made records the way that we like to make records, so it was great. It was a great combo.
Well, I know he made at least one or two Connells records that I really love, and I mean, he just makes great-sounding records.
Yeah, definitely. I love the sound of them. Like I said, I mean, that was a big thing for me, was just knowing that this guy absolutely knows how to make a record sound amazing. And you know, it was just nothing but what great. We tracked in the studio in Brooklyn that had a Neve console, and that was a kind of a must. And we tracked everything live, and then we went out to California for a few weeks or a few weekends, really, a few long weekends, and just did some overdubbing. But we didn't, you know, it wasn't a lot of time. I think all told, we might have spent a total of 3 weeks recording the album.
Wow. Very cool, man. And Obsolete seems like it was a song that was probably a lot of fun to write. I mean, appropriately, there's a lot of, you know, fun and, yes, Obsolete references in that one. And so it seems like creatively, you obviously probably had a lot of choices what you could have put in there, and it was probably fun putting it all together and figuring out what worked best.
Oh, yeah. Obsolete was a really great song because it actually, I was in the middle of a writing session with this guy, Zach Malloy.
Right.
Zach used to be in that band, the Nixons.
The Nixons, yeah.
Yeah. So finding Zach in Nashville was really funny because we had, you know, sort of had very similar experiences. And I wrote the song Snapshot with Zach. And mm-hmm. He wrote that song in like an hour and a half, and it's still one of my favorite songs I've ever been a part of. We got together on another day, and we were kind of working through this idea. You know, we had like sort of maybe half a song or three quarters of a song, and we were just kind of rolling this boulder up a hill. And Obsolete literally happened in the middle of writing a different song. We just completely was like, wait a minute, this is a much cooler idea. And we just put the other thing away and kind of wrote Obsolete in about an hour, and it was almost like, wow, that was too easy. But it was fun. That was a great fun song to write, and sort of sets us up though. I can't wait for all the reviews that will mention how ironic it is that we're Obsolete, and you know, so that's been the fun part, is waiting for that.
Well, I thought that was, yeah, that was kind of a brave lyric, you know, mentioning Train and Counting Crows, because, I mean, your album was one of those albums that wound up, you know, being in dollar bins everywhere.
Yep.
Which, that's really not an insult. It just speaks to how many, you know, people in that time period, like, had a copy of that record. Like, there were a lot of copies of that record out there.
You know, the thing is, you have to have a sense of humor about everything.
For
and
sure.
We've always been able to, you know, poke fun at ourselves to a degree. And nobody here is under any illusions that we are going to set the world on fire. You know, we're an Act Two band, and I also have, you know, we're coming from a position of like, I know we're good at what we do. It's just a matter of, you know, whether or not enough people are going to get a chance to hear this and get a chance to like it enough that we get to go out and play shows and make more records. And that's what any artist is ultimately trying to do. And we have now been recording and playing and enjoying that for almost, 20 years as a band. So, you know, we've already been successful. It would be great if we had an opportunity to, you know, go out on a, you know, a higher level. But at the same time, you know, you just have to kind of appreciate the things as they are. So, yeah, I'd take the Counting Crows career in a heartbeat.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like the stuff like Obsolete, a tune like Green Light, like it's interesting because, like, you have songs like that that I think are maybe what the average person would expect from 9 Days as far as, you know, clever lyrics and stuff like that. But, like, then it's like, you know, songs like the title track, you know, like Star, like Conspiracy, that really kind of show the depth, the lyrical depth of this band.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I mean, Conspiracy was another fun one to write. And Star, to me, is almost like, Star is almost a bookend to Story of a Girl in a very strange way, because it really is it's the story picked up 15 years later. You
yeah.
know, the girl in Story of a Girl is my wife. You know, we got married and we had a family and we have a couple of kids now. And so, you know, if you look at the narrative of Story of a Girl and then you pick it up 15 years later, well, then you'd have Star. And so, you know, there's a lot, you know, look, they're pop songs. They're 3.5 minute pop songs largely, but it doesn't mean that there isn't something being said in them. And Snapshots is another one, or the song Snapshot is another one where lyrically, I mean, I'm pulling some of those, a lot of the lines in that song are pulling from things I've literally said in real life. You know, and the chorus was my mantra as a teenager, you know, like when my friends were hanging out on a Saturday night and, you know, guys were just kind of sitting around. One of my motivational speeches was, I used to say, well, life is the stories we're going to tell when we get older. You know, do you want your story to be you sat home on Saturday night? And
wow.
It was sort of my, you know, my rallying cry for let's go. So when Zach and I were working on that idea, I said that to him and he's like, that's it. That's our lyric. And we just literally almost took it verbatim and, you know, created a song out of it.
And I mean, Conspiracy, I mean, it seems like it's probably been a while since DB Cooper has found his way into the lyrics of a song. So props on that.
I hope so.
Yeah,
yeah, thank you. That one was just a ton of fun to write. And that started, I read tons and tons of those conspiracy things, or, you know, not even just conspiracies. Like, I was on a kick for a while just reading everything on Andy Kaufman I could find. And,
right.
So we were somehow or another just sitting around talking about all these guys that are supposedly, you know, not dead. And, you know, Andy Kaufman came up, Jim Morrison, of course, and Elvis. And I just said something like, my God, it would be amazing if just one of them would come back. You know, just one of all these people would just, you know, show up. Like, Andy would be probably the best because he's the guy who everybody thinks, you know, really tried to pull off a scam. And if that guy just walked back into reality, it would be a mind blower. And so we just started goofing around on the chorus and we were laughing, but like, this is great. And then it became, well, how do we angle this into, you know, a song? And it, you know, that just sort of, that's how that evolved.
Well, and you worked the Paul McCartney reference in there in a clever way as well.
Yes. Yeah, I was hoping, you know, I know some people get pissed about it, but I thought it was pretty funny. That one was fun. That Paul McCartney line was a lot of fun.
You know, I have to go back to Obsolete briefly, and that just is, I mean, you mentioned the Nixons, and I loved what Zach did with the Nixons, but it's been interesting because, like, the songwriting that he's done since the Nixons, since he became, you know, somewhat of an it guy as far as songwriting, like, you don't ever, I think, really hear kind of the stamp of what he did with the Nixons in his songwriting now. And that Obsolete, that's one of those where I actually hear that stamp that's a little bit of a callback to some of the later stuff he did with the Nixons. So it's kind of cool to hear that.
I don't know this, but I imagine it might have been fun for Zach to write those kinds of songs
yeah.
with me, just because we, you know, I doubt he gets a lot of call to harking back to a big sort of pop rock chorus. So yeah, I think we had a really good chemistry just sitting down and writing together. We wrote a bunch of songs, only a couple of them are on the album. There's a couple others we wrote that I think are great that just for one reason or another we didn't pick for the album. But I hope to write some more with him. It's just real easy, and I think we have a very similar, you know, sort of perspective on lyrics, melody, and songwriting craft. So it was fun.
Do I understand correctly that it was kind of Brian that, you know, brought some of these outside, like, songwriting folks into the mix for this record? Is that how that happened?
Yeah, indirectly and directly. I mean, Brian moved down to Nashville probably 7 or 8 years ago, and I guess maybe a little longer, maybe not, I don't know, but kind of pre the really big Nashville blow up. He'd always loved country, like legit old country, like stuff that, you know, I still have a hard time listening to, and I won't name names, but so him going down there wasn't really that strange. And so he got involved in it. In Nashville, the writing scene is very, very different than any other experience I've ever had. And those guys are, they're craftsmen. You know, you walk in a room and you've got an appointment. You know, you've got from 12 to 3 or, you know, whatever. You got a 3-hour window. That's what it feels like to me. You kind of got 3 hours, you know, and you've got to make something happen. So I was definitely intimidated by that idea. I'd never written like that. And so we would go down there and you'd walk in a room and, you know, guys are just kind of on their game and, but they're also trying to create a spark. You know, it's you can't walk in there with sort of, you know, half-assed ideas. I mean, you sort of have these conversations and just a spark gets ignited. That's how Conspiracy happened. You know, it was just a conversation, just a bunch of guys sitting around, you know, bullshitting about something until a great idea popped up. And I guess it doesn't always happen, but Brian introduced me to that world, and our management being down in Nashville, I just started making a lot more trips. And you know, we set up some rights with people Brian knew. And then another great thing about writing a hit was that people were definitely interested in writing, you know, with us because of that. So we, that opened some doors up and we got to sit down with some really great writers, and it was a great experience. It was cool.
Very cool. And you've continued to like write and release things in between 9 Days Records on your own. And as you know, some people will kind of go off and do the solo thing and they never end up going back to their main thing. What is it that you kind of like about doing 9 Days music?
It's a band. That's the biggest thing. You know, like with my quote unquote, I mean, I did 3 like solo records, and it's not a band, you know, it's basically me. I end up playing a lot of the instruments, which it's a great therapeutic and cathartic thing to do. But I miss sitting in a room and, you know, playing with the band. And Brian brings a certain whole aesthetic to the music that, you know, he and I are partners for a reason. You know, I think we add things to each other's music, and I loved doing those solo things, and I'm positive I'll do more. But, you know, the 9 Days experience is just different. And, you know, I'm not going to replicate that in something else. So as long as, you know, 9 Days is fun, we're going to keep doing it. And for the most part, you know, it's been pretty good for 20 years. So
what do you think Brian brings to your process that's helpful?
You know, I think he has his own sort of BS meter. Like I know when Brian's into an idea of mine and when he isn't. So simply things get weeded out of 9 Days based on all of us having enough enthusiasm for it. So that makes the whole gauntlet of a song a lot more challenging. So there's that. And as a guitar player, Brian is super creative with parts. I love the parts that he comes up with for the songs. And you know, the funny thing is, you know, Brian and I have been in bands together for, God, over 20 years at this point. And every time we do a session, you know, the producer is always like, wow, man, you guys just sing amazing together. And we're just kind of like, I guess.
Yeah.
I think our voices, after all these years, we just really know the little nuance and subtleties and inflections and so forth. We don't think about it. It's just we've been doing it forever. So you know, there is, I guess, something to the sounds that we create when it's all of us making that music. And that includes all the guys, you know, in the band. So I think there's just this, a certain DNA that the songs take on when it's us playing them as opposed to anybody else. And that's true for any band. So,
what was it like for you revisiting Absolutely and re-recording it for this record?
I didn't want to do it. I didn't really feel super excited about doing it, but at the same time, it kind of, you know, we're living in this very interesting time for music where the ownership of music is really undergoing a lot of changes. And, you know, we've all read stories about artists who had no rights to, I mean, freaking the whole John Fogerty story blows my mind. That guy couldn't even play songs live without getting sued.
Oh, yeah.
Because of stuff. So you know, the fact that we were able to reclaim ownership of the song was part of the process. The version that we did in 2000, to me, is the sort of quintessential version. And that has everything to do with, because it was written at that time, how it was recorded at that time. It was mixed by Chris Lord-Alge, who was just a sort of god of that sound. Not that he can't do other things, but when it comes to just creating this incredible, you know, pop radio guitar song, I mean, the guy is just, you know, it's a science that he has nailed. And that version is to me, is a crystallized moment, or, you know, this moment in amber. But what we did this time around was sort of a little more like, hey, this is how we do this song 16 years later.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to replace the other. It's just more like to sort of reclaim a little ownership and maybe, of course, bridge that gap between the two albums. You know, it was meant to be more like a bonus thing. It's not sort of part of the album's narrative. It's more just there as, you know, a way to reconnect the dots.
That makes sense. And, you know, one of the other things that's a part of your life these days is that you're an English teacher, which I think is really cool. And I kind of wondered, like, what kind of sent you in that direction? Were you always, like, a fan of literature and stuff like that?
Yeah, totally. That was sort of a no-brainer. I mean, my entire life, I was always a, you know, big reader. I just always spent way too much time in libraries as a, you know, sort of middle school, junior high kid, and even through high school. And basically, you know, look, I always, and this is the truth, I don't ever remember a time in my life, even as a young kid, that I didn't know I wanted to make music, even before I knew how to do it at all. So I always knew what I wanted, but there was a part of me that, you know, going through high school and all your friends are sort of, you know, filling out college applications and they're, you know, setting their future on that course. And I knew that that really wasn't for me, but I also found that, you know, just sort of like a little, again, it's a little daunting. You're like, you know, you're going off on this trail that no one else is taking.
Yeah.
And in the back of my mind, or maybe not the back of my mind, but my senior year, I took a class called College Reading, College Prep, and my teacher was awesome. And basically I was like, that's the only other thing that I ever want to do, is what he's doing, you know, like sitting there talking about literature, breaking it down and, you know, digging into it and coming up with all these other meanings and ideas. And so I kind of fell in love with that, and which makes sense, you know, as a sort of a writer and even a performer, it's the same skill set. So when, you know, time came and I was 32, I think, I just went back and I enrolled in a community college, and, you know, from there just jumped over to a, you know, a 4-year school and got my master's and started teaching.
Wow. Very cool. Yeah. When I was in school, it's like, the English teacher was always like the guy, and he's still a guy that I'm in touch with to this day. So
right,
it's like,
right,
if you've got to go for a plan B, I thought that was a really kind of interesting and cool plan B to go for.
Yeah. It was, like I said, it was really the only other thing I ever truly considered doing. And I got to tell you, like, you know, I loved going to school as an adult. I mean, I totally loved it. I had such a great experience. And, you know, I always say that you think about the sort of the song as a music career, but that song also gave me the opportunity to go back and get an education as an adult in a way that I never could have otherwise. And that is a huge, you know, just accomplishment and gift. So there's lots of ways that, you know, music has a positive influence.
Oh, that's cool. Very cool, man. Do your students know of your musical side?
Yeah, they totally know.
Nice.
My wife teaches Italian as well, so like we ended up working at the same school. So it's sort of part of the culture, being as she was the story of the girl. So
yeah,
it's not a big deal to them. I mean, I'll bring my guitar in, and they love to talk about it and stuff, but it's, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still their English teacher who's making them read, you know, The Great Gatsby or Catcher in the Rye or something. So,
right.
You know, it's not all you know, it's not a concert in the classroom every day, that's for sure.
Well, wrapping up here, there's the, I guess, what's the album release show on July 16th in Bayshore, New York. And then I also see you have a August 22nd show on the books in Illinois. What's kind of the plan once this record's up and out there?
We added a couple of shows. We're doing Chicago on July 15th. We're doing Nashville on July 23rd. And then the plan is the song Green Light goes to radio towards the end of June. The record comes out July 8th. And the plan is to hope that enough people are like, hey, this is pretty cool. We're going to play it. We're going to put it on our TV commercial or whatever so that people hear it. And we have the opportunity to go play as many places as we can and then hopefully continue making records. It's just to kind of keep going.
Awesome. Well, anything else you want folks to know about?
No, I think that's it. Just, you know, the shows that are coming up, and I'll make sure you have a full list in case you're able to plug any of those. And
absolutely.
And then the record, you know, the record coming out July, big thing.
There's our interview with John Hampson in 9 days. Our thanks to John for taking the time to speak with us today. As I mentioned, the new 9 Days record, Snapshots, that's being released on July 8th. You can visit the 9 Days website, 9daysmusic.com, for all the places where you can get it. I'll also throw a link into the show notes where you can grab the iTunes pre-order and get those advanced songs that I mentioned earlier. Thanks so much for listening to the Lost Together podcast. We'll be back next week with another new episode.